I'm Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, and you're listening to Jazz's Backstage Pass.
And I'm your host, Brian Zimmerman. My guest today is vocalist Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, as bright a star as they come in the jazz universe. She exploded onto the scene in 2010 after taking first place in that year's Thelonious Monk International Jazz Vocal Competition, where her unique blend of blues singer attitude, Broadway stage presence, and modern jazz aesthetic made her an immediate sensation. In 2013, she released her breakout album, Womanchild, to high critical acclaim, receiving a Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Album. Honors like the Jazz Journalism Association's Female Vocalist of the Year Award would follow, and in 2016, her album For One to Love would finally bring the Grammy home. Then, in 2018, she'd do it all again, receiving another Grammy for Best Jazz Vocal Album for her two-disc smash hit, Dreams and Daggers. Salvant is just one of seven incredible artists who make up Artemis, Great Women in Jazz, an exciting new supergroup founded by pianist Rennie Rosnes, and including trumpeter Ingrid Jensen, tenor saxophonist Melissa Aldana, clarinetist Anat Cohen, bassist Noriko Ueda, and drummer Allison Miller. The group will perform at the Adrian Arch Center for the Performing Arts in Salvant's hometown of Miami, Florida, on December 7th as part of the venue's Jazz Roots series. Jazzes spoke with Salvant over the phone about the upcoming performance, and also about the realities of being a woman in the jazz world today. Let's get to it. And Cecile, you've been involved with this group from the very beginning, correct?
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the formation of the group, how Rennie reached out to you, and how she kind of pitched the idea for Artemis?
Well, I can give you the true story, or I can give you the official one. I don't know which I'll get in trouble for, but I'm pretty candid, so I'll just be honest.
Bring it on.
This French agent organized a show in France, in Paris, with an all-female band, and so that's how we first got together. And then we did a tour a year after that, also organized by this French agent. But the bass player and drummer couldn't make it, so we changed the bass player and drummer, and this is when Rennie sort of started to organize what the band would be. And then we kind of realized that we really liked playing with each other, and it just became less about, you know, let's do the super group, and more about, like, we really like to play music with each other. So that's kind of how it happened.
Nice. And, you know, I kind of wanted to talk about the vibe a little bit, because, you know, I was curious how it felt to be involved in a band where you're united, you know, and not even by gender, but kind of the common cause, which is to kind of raise, you know, awareness of women in jazz, and to, you know, encourage other women to kind of speak up and for themselves in jazz. And I'm thinking of other groups that are kind of united by common political causes, social causes, cultural causes. Does that affect the musical dynamic? Do you guys vibe really well? Just because you're kind of united behind that common cause?
I think we vibe really well because they're great musicians. I think
this is true.
I think I might very well be in a situation where I have the same political cause as other musicians, but if we don't vibe musically, it can only go so far, you know? Like, the ideals can, our political ideals can only go so far in, like, carrying the thing. I think I think it's really important to remember just how incredible these musicians are.
Totally.
You know, and how accomplished they are. And it has nothing to do with their, you know, with what I feel about them as people or the conversations we have, just like purely from a musical standpoint, they are incredible. You know, like even if we had no conversations and we had no thoughts or ideas or communication about anything, like they're undeniably great, you know? And so to me, that's really the really rewarding part about this project is that, sure, it's all women and that, you know, in a way we can feel like we can all, you know, pat ourselves on the back and feel good about whatever the optics of that are for people. But for me, the rewarding thing is that, yes, it's all women, but more importantly, it's all really, really great musicians.
Totally.
You know, really unique and creative players.
Right.
And
Sorry, go ahead.
That's great. That's a really wonderful situation to be in. You know what I mean?
Totally. And, you know, kind of from all different backgrounds, different styles, different generations.
Absolutely. Different generations, different countries. You know, like there's a lot. There's a lot to talk about and think about with these people.
Right. And that diversity of influences, that diversity of voices, you know, tends exactly like you said, regardless of, you know, political cause or persuasion or gender, just to make for great music.
Absolutely, I think so.
Which kind of leads, that does kind of lead me to another question, which is, you touched on it earlier, Artemis is, by all means, just a great group of musicians. It could have been called, you know, it's billed as Artemis, the Great Women in Jazz, but this could be Artemis, Great Artists in Jazz. How far or
Absolutely.
How close do you think we are to getting there? You know, where this is not even billed as Great Women in Jazz. This is just come see Artemis.
Well, you know, I'm a cynic and I'm a pessimist. And so I find it important to preface that, anything that I say with that, because I do feel like, you know, if you just say Artemis, you're removing an entire marketing gimmick
mm-hmm.
that is important for venues, important for promoters who want to sell the show, you know? So it's interesting because in one way, as a member of Artemis, I'm uninterested in having it billed as an all-female band. I couldn't care less, you know, that it would, like, I don't feel like that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
However, from, you know, the promoter standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, from like the story of the band, like, you know, whatever story people want to tell of this band, it's easier, it's cleaner, it's more attractive to people, for lack of a better word, if you can kind of throw that on it. However, you know, if it was an all black band, you know, the way we would talk about it would be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really fascinating to me just having to juggle and grapple with these ideas, you know, of like, on the one hand, I think it's really important to have women tell stories, to have women be at the forefront
mm-hmm.
of certain genres and musical movements and all kinds of things. However, I personally would like to not think or care about gender, you know,
mm-hmm.
and especially now that we're in a world where we're more and more getting acquainted with non-binary people
mm-hmm.
and people who don't even think of gender in like, in this like man or woman thing, like it's just we're getting to a point where it's just very, very, I mean, I don't think it's coming to a head, but you know, like it's
certainly something we're reckoning with, whereas before we didn't
absolutely.
Even, you know, it was like
absolutely,
right,
absolutely.
Right. And that's important. You know, and at the same time, I spoke recently with Ingrid Jensen a little bit about this group, but we talked also about some of the very real obstacles and challenges that she faced coming up as a young musician. And the main thing I took away was, you know, she would tell me that starting out, she was not really on call. She was not the first person people called for, you know, side person positions.
Who said this? I'm sorry.
Ingrid Jensen.
Ingrid was, okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and she was not getting those calls for the, you know, side person jobs in the studio, for the touring. And so she really took it upon herself to go out there and create her own leadership positions. And she said that was tough, but, you know, that experience kind of led to, you know, the leadership role she has now, you know, where she's leading some amazing band. She really learned how to kind of be a leader kind of from the outside, from the margins. I'm wondering if you had similar experiences coming up, or if you faced any obstacles like that.
I can't say that I did, because of the fact that I'm a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a heavy tradition of female singers. I am not shattering any kind of glass ceiling. I'm not, you know, subverting any expectations by singing.
Mm-hmm.
It is what is to be expected. You know, I'm a Black female singer. That's not like, no one is saying, oh my gosh, can you, like, what must it be like to do this thing that no one expects you to do? Everybody expects me to do this. And so it's the things that I have had to sort of think about and deal with are maybe of another order, but certainly not a sort of sexism in terms of, like, you can't do, like, you're not going to be able to do this as well as a man.
Right.
In fact, I feel like for singing, quite often it is the opposite. People really expect women to sing, and if you're a man, it's a little bit more rare, and so you have to kind of come in with a different, it's kind of a flipped situation.
Right.
I mean, not flipped, because it'll never be flipped, but you know what I mean? Like, it's...
Right.
It's not the same.
But on the same hand, I know you experienced some pushback in sort of the subjects that you very bravely decided to cover, be it with Wives Can Be Lovers, you know, and some of the early blues singers material, which a lot of people back then considered, oh, too raunchy, you know, for a female singer to be singing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, still facing some oppression and some criticism from an establishment that may not be used to what you're trying to do.
Sure. I mean, I'm interested in questions of identity. I'm interested in stereotypes. I think they're fascinating. I'm interested in this long, twisted history of American music. I'm interested in minstrel music and blackface and all kinds of really American traditions that we have inherited that are still in our music today. And so, you know, I certainly am thinking about questions of identity and what does it mean to be X, Y, or Z today in America? What does it mean to be a Black woman in America today? What does, you know, how has that idea changed or evolved or transformed or not, you know, and how has music served certain political interests, served certain power dynamics, held certain power dynamics in place a lot of the time? You know, how has it been a tool to both help people out of their shackles, but also, you know, imprison them in other ways? Like, all of those things are very interesting to me. And so I like to explore them in my music, absolutely.
Awesome. And I imagine some of those themes are taken up in your new work, Ogress, which I've been hearing awesome things about. We're
thank you so much. It's definitely something that is really important to me.
I was wondering whether, you know, because obviously you've got this kind of fantastical theme, you know, of the ogress, but it opens up doors for all kinds of, you know, political, social, and cultural themes. I'm wondering which one kind of came first. Did you just have a fascination, you know, with stories like these and have a story to tell and then work some of those themes in? Or did you want to have something to say about, just like you were saying, marginalized people, you know, people that may not fit in the mainstream? How'd that project come about?
I think it started with the story, but you know, it's really hard. It's kind of a chicken or egg thing.
Right.
It started with this ogress story, but, you know, why am I interested in female monsters? You know, like, well, that's because I'm interested in representations of women and representations of wicked women and you know, witches and monstrous women and ugly women. And why am I interested in that? You know, so essentially all of these things, it's linked. But certainly for ogress, I mean, I started to come up with the idea, and for a while I'd been interested in these mythologies of female monsters and what are those representations, what do they mean, and the story sort of began to, I started to think of the story slowly, little by little, it began to emerge and eventually turned into ogress.
Awesome. Well, like I said, I really hope I get to see it. Hopefully you'll bring it down to Miami like you're doing with Artemis.
I would love that.
And that's kind of my last question. We'll end on a little bit of a lighter note, but this performance is a homecoming for you. Do you still have roots here? Do you have family here? How does it feel to be coming back home?
Yeah, I have family in Miami. I'm super, super excited to come home. I'm so, so happy. And I can't wait. I actually really can't wait. I feel like I don't sing in Miami often enough. And so anytime I'm there singing, it's just such a joy. You know, my family comes to the show and I'm really, really excited.
Jazziz would like to thank Cecile McLaurin-Salvant for chatting with us today, as well as Cheryl Feuerstein of East West Media for making her appearance possible. We'd also like to thank the Adrian Arsch Center for the Performing Arts and the Jazz Root Series for hosting great ensembles like Artemis. Upcoming performances in the Jazz Root Series include the Joshua Redman Quartet on January 18th, a tribute to novelist Ralph Ellison called Jazz in the Key of Ellison on February 8th, the Robert Glasper-led supergroup R plus R equals Now on March 8th, and bossa nova sensation Sergio Mendez playing From Brazil with Love on April 12th. To purchase tickets, visit www.arschcenter.org. That's www.arschcenter.org. The theme song for Jazziz Backstage Pass is Folk Song by pianist Emmett Cohen from his album Master's Legacy Series, Volume 1. Thanks a lot, everyone. We'll see you next time.